And good morning, this is Dr. John McDougall joining you on the Northern California radio station. Listen to this. In a large fraction of medical stable patients with coronary disease who are urged to undergo coronary angiography, the procedure can be safely deferred. While there may be a limitation in terms of generalization, this experience to all patients with coronary artery disease, we reasonably conclude that an estimated 50% of the coronary angiography currently being undertaken in the United States is unnecessary, or at least could be postponed. Now, where would you expect to see that statement? In one of McDougall's books, or maybe in the Journal of the American Medical Association? Do you think somebody could be bold enough and influential enough to get a statement like that published in the Journal of the American Medical Association? Well, our guest today, Thomas Graboys, who is Associate Professor of Medicine of Harvard University and the Director of the Law and Cardiovascular Center in Boston, did just that, and that's the second time that he challenged the medical establishment. Dr. Graboy? Hello? Dr. Graboy?
Yeah.
No, did you hear that introduction?
Yeah.
All right. How do you get away with that?
How do I get away with that?
Yeah. I mean, how do you write articles that say that half the business, you wrote an article back a few years ago, I think it was in 1978.
Yeah.
An article, or let's see, 1987 in the
right.
Journal of the American Medical Association that said half the bypass surgery is done unnecessarily too. Don't you get a lot of objection to that? And how does a journal like the Journal of the American Medical Association find that in line with their policy?
Well, I don't think the Journal of the AMA has any particular policy. We submitted a paper, and it was reviewed by, so-called peer-reviewed, by three cardiologists, and both the 1987 paper and our paper that was just published in 1992, and they felt that it was important data that was worth publishing, and it was published, and clearly there are folks who are upset with the conclusions, but that's the kind of the facts.
But the implications are so great. I mean, just in this day and age when we're talking about medical health care and costs, you're talking about half the business could be cut right now if we just were honest.
Well, I'm not necessarily saying there's issues of honesty or dishonesty, and the figure that we stated of 50% is in some ways a guesstimate. It is a figure that's based on our making several assumptions. The data, the paper that you're talking about, refers to a group of approximately 170 patients who got sent to us for a second opinion as to the need for a heart catheterization, and we happened to find in that group that about 75% did not need the procedure. And we then, in the conclusions in the paper, said, well, look, we're not saying that 75% of folks don't need it, but 50% is a reasonable figure. That has been our experience over the last 10 years or so.
Well, that's very interesting, and you were being very conservative, and you didn't say 75 or 80%, which is, I think, what your figures actually showed. 80% didn't need the procedure, at least on your first, second opinion. And I don't want to push this too hard, but when you make statements that we concur with the estimate of Winslow and colleagues that approximately 50% of patients undergo inappropriate coronary bypass graft surgery and suggest that at least that many coronary angiograms may be unnecessary, at least deferred. I have to say, Dr. Thomas Graboy, that there's a matter of ethics involved here.
Well, what's clear is there are major economic factors that we have overtrained specialists in cardiology and cardiovascular surgery, that we've overbuilt open heart units, and there are major economic incentives for hospitals. In fact, for many hospitals, the high reimbursement procedures, such as open heart surgery or angioplasty, that's the balloon procedure, or heart catheterizations, are the economic lifeblood for their particular hospital. And what's troubling to us in particular is that the death rate from this disease, hardening of the arteries, has gone down approximately 50% over a three-decade period between 1950 and 1980, and that had nothing to do with the procedures and everything to do with people's lifestyle. Treating the blood pressure, stopping smoking, diet, et cetera, and better medication. And yet, over the past decade, there's been an absolutely explosive growth in these procedures. And therefore, we have to ask, how do we explain it?
And how do we explain it?
Well, we explain it by, as I said, overtraining of specialists, over development of these different bypass units, a major economic factor. Regrettably, if we paid reimbursed physicians to sit and talk with a patient for 30 minutes about, or 45 minutes about their heart problem, at an equal rate and we paid an equal amount for that physician doing a procedure, you'd see a lot less procedures done.
So it's a matter of economics. That's basically
what
it is.
Well, I think that's part of it, but there's also a public image of this. I think the public presses for the technology because the public feels that this is a fix-it problem. I have a plumbing problem. I have some blockages. Go in, do a bypass, or do a balloon, and it's all better. But it's a much, much more complicated picture than simply plumbing. So it's multi-factor. I mean, it would be improper to say this is purely economic and it's purely because docs are looking to make big salaries, or hospitals are looking for it for the economic lifeblood. There are many, many factors here, although economics is clearly one major element.
Okay. Regardless of the motivation behind it,
yeah.
What does the patient do to help save themselves an inappropriate procedure?
Well, I think that we are in a stage where people really need to be informed, quote, consumers. They have to realize that medications we have now are very, very effective at treating this problem. And there are really three issues. Number one, am I going to drop dead from this problem? Number two, am I going to have a heart attack? And number three, how do I treat my symptoms? And the fact is that the medications are equally effective to bypass or to angioplasty in terms of preventing death and preventing a heart attack. As far as relief of symptoms, that very much depends upon the level of symptom that the individual has, how much chest discomfort they're having, whether the medication helps it, whether they'll take the medication or not. But it's important not to go into a procedure thinking that if I don't have any symptoms, I'm having a bypass because it's going to protect me from dying or from having a heart attack. In fact, the medications may work equally as well as the operation.
Well, I want to address that point because you said something very important in this same paper. The paper impressed me tremendously. I'm sure you're getting that impression. It says, at the present time, there is no study randomizing patients to coronary angiography or continued empirical medical therapy. Moreover, there is no control study that addresses the issue as to whether coronary angioplasty improves prognosis.
Yeah.
So, in other words, what you're saying is that we haven't shown that that works, so you're saying that we haven't shown that bypass surgery works except in a limited number of cases, and we haven't shown that drug therapy works. In other words, are you saying nothing works?
Well, no, I think a lot of things work. What I'm saying is that you can't trumpet bypass surgery or angioplasty as being clearly superior to medical therapy in preventing one's death or preventing a heart attack. That is a key point. It is, to me, an incredibly upsetting situation when 10 years ago we did 30,000 angioplasties in the United States, and this year we'll probably do 300,000. That means a tenfold increase in the balloon procedure when there is not one study to say that the balloon is any better than medication as far as preventing one's death or preventing a heart attack. But there's one important qualification, John. I'm going to let you talk. But the main thing is that if a patient is having significant symptoms of chest discomfort, waking up at night, it's occurring at rest, and the medication is not effective, then they should have an intervention. They should have either an angioplasty, if it's appropriate, or a bypass. That's the minority of individuals with this disease.
To relieve incapacitating chest pain unrelieved by good medical therapy,
right,
is the way we say it. Okay, now I have to get something really straight in my mind because I've heard what you just said over and over and over again, and that is that medical therapy is as good as bypass surgery, but I honestly, as an internist, don't know of any medical therapy that does anything but relieve chest pain, except, you know, in very minor controversial points. Do you?
Well, I think that it's not. Medical therapy does many things. If you're using medical therapy to treat hypertension or high blood pressure, you're using medical therapy to lower cholesterol, you're using aspirin to prevent blood clots, all of these things will help reduce the progression of the disease.
All right, I'll buy that.
Yeah.
I'll buy that. But and maybe beta blockers too, post heart attacks.
Sure.
So and when but the thing is that bypass patients get all those things too.
Well, I think the other point of it is this is not a process that's going to go away if you have an operation. As I said earlier, it's not a plumbing problem. It's more complicated. The process goes on. So if you have high blood pressure, it's going to have to be treated after the operation or the balloon angioplasty. If you have high cholesterol, it's going to have to be dealt with. You can't smoke. All of these factors have got to be part of a lifestyle change and a continued use of medications regardless of the intervention.
Are you real strong on diet and lifestyle change?
Well, I think that you've got some folks up in Northern California which have certainly been very important in that. I think that the Ornish area in terms of Dean Ornish's ideas are certainly consonant with what we're doing here in the East, and that is to really concentrate on getting people's cholesterol down, having them on a regular exercise program, trying to defuse them as far as issues of stress, and particularly the areas of anger and hostility, which are of great concern to us.
Dr. Thomas Grayboy, do you believe that atherosclerosis is a reversible disease?
Tough question. I think you can slow the progress of it. I think that there's some evidence to say that it may be reversible in some individuals, but the problem is that those individuals are going to be, again, a minority. It's very difficult to get people to set aside an hour a day to exercise and 45 minutes to meditate.
But if they did, if they changed their diet to a diet consistent of a population that doesn't have coronary artery disease, if they did exercise, if they didn't smoke, is it a reversible disease?
Oh, I think there's certainly a significant part of it is reversible.
All right. This is Dr. John McDougall. My guest, Dr. Thomas Grayboys. Dr. Grayboys is Associate Professor of Medicine at Harvard, Director of Law and Cardiovascular Center, and also writes articles like The Appropriateness of Use of Coronary Artery Bypass Grafts. Well, that's not his, but we'll get to that one. Results of Second Opinion Trials Among Patients Recommended for Coronary Angiography. The reason I had that study out in front of me was because, Dr. Grayboys, there was an original study by Winslow that was done, about 88 it was done, on the appropriateness of the use of coronary artery bypass grafting. And he said that about half the bypass grafting was done for inappropriate reasons. And then they come out with this article just in February last month, and they say the appropriateness of the use of coronary artery bypass grafting in the state of New York, that it's done appropriately. Can you explain the discrepancy between the 50% inappropriateness and the 9% inappropriateness between the two studies?
Yeah, the point of it is there's several issues with that. First of all, the RAND group that published those three articles essentially put together a panel of, quote, experts. And within that panel of experts, obviously, you're going to have folks who've got a certain level of bias. And they reviewed procedures and both angioplasty and bypass surgery and angiography and found that in at least within the people they reviewed within New York State, that there seemed to be a low level of inappropriate procedure. But there was also a high level of equivocal procedures. And when you're dealing with equivocal procedures, then it raises a number of issues. In other words, there's a subjective quality. And if there's a subjective quality about whether a procedure is needed or not, it moves away from a situation whereby it is absolutely clear that you need a procedure. And from my point of view, I think that if I were going to undertake that procedure, I'd want to know what are the risks and what are the benefits, what are the absolute proven risks and proven benefits. So, and the other point, I think, with the RAND studies is that just because a procedure is, you can do it, it doesn't mean it should be done. And in New York State, by the way, there are quite significant restrictions on procedures being done as well. So all of that, I think, helps to explain why there was a difference in the earlier RAND study that you just quoted, John, and the one that was just published.
Well, they say that in the editorial also. They say something to the effect that the low prevalence of procedures and the strict limitations of the number of sites at which the invasive cardiac procedures are performed is the reason that the New York study only showed around a 9% inappropriateness or equivocal rate, whereas Winslow, which I know you quote in your paper, and I have to assume that you believe that he's probably closer to the fact,
yeah,
represents what happens in the general population of people. Half of the people get an operation that is done for equivocal or inappropriate reasons.
When people ask us, how can you come up with these figures? I mean, I just ask a very simple question. If the mortality from the disease is going down from all the kinds of things that you talk about, and lifestyle change and diet, et cetera, how do we explain the fact that the number of bypasses have doubled over the last 6 or 7 years? I mean, we're not dealing with an epidemic of the disease. We're dealing with the fact that there's an epidemic of open heart programs.
Yes, consumer beware. This is Dr. John McDougall. My guest is Dr. Thomas Grayboys, and our first guest. So you have a question for Dr. Grayboys.
Yes. I'm a 23-year-old heart transplant recipient that's been pretty healthy for the last 6 years. And 5 months ago, I was diagnosed with atherosclerosis that's become quite progressive, so much so that they've actually relisted me on the transplant list for a second transplant. And I'm wondering if you know of any evidence for cardiac transplant patients, if there's any evidence of reversal there.
Yeah, I don't know the answer to that. I think as you know, and people who are listening may not be aware, however, that is one of the problems with folks undergoing transplant, is that there can be a rapid development of hardening of the arteries, and then people may have to then come back for a second transplant. But I don't know any evidence that would suggest that. But I assume you're being taken care of in the Northern California area for this, and the folks there would probably be able to advise you about it.
Right.
And a good diet would be appropriate, wouldn't it, in a case like
sure.
this?
Yeah, I've been on your program for about 11 days now, and feel a lot better. But I'm just wondering if it's something less drastic. Is there, there's a possibility of something less drastic to take place?
I'm afraid I don't. I just don't have information on that.
Well, certainly, certainly, Dr. Graybois would encourage you to take the best care of yourself as possible and to delay the surgery as long as is appropriate. This is Dr. John McDougall on the Northern California Radio Network. We have Guy from Santa Clara, and if you'd like to get involved in the conversation, the number is 707-270-1350 and 1-800-570-TALK, and there are lines open at both those numbers. Let's talk to Guy in Santa Clara. Hello, Guy.
Hi. I just had a question for you, Doctor, for the doctor back east.
Dr. Graybois.
I have a copy of the CAST study right here, and I'm just kind of curious, when I hear half the bypasses are no good or three-fourths, I see they say that there's no difference between death or infarction in the whole group, and it looks to me as I kind of peruse this thing that it looks like almost all of them are not good. Can you have any comment on that?
Well, you're talking about the coronary artery surgery study.
Correct, yes.
The CAST study. Yeah, that was published in 1983, and what I think was important about that when it initially came out was that we could define a low-risk group of individuals who clearly were going to do as well with medical therapy as opposed to surgical.
Radio Network, my guest, Dr. Thomas Graybois. He is Associate Professor of Medicine, Harvard Medical School, Director of the Lawn Cardiovascular Center in Boston, which is the most prestigious cardiovascular group in the country. And he also writes in journals like the Journal of the American Medical Association, articles such as results of a second opinion trial among patients recommended for coronary angiography, and the results, he also has a study on the results of second opinions on bypass surgery, which indicates half of the procedures could be avoided. And I say by a little bit of honesty injected into the medical profession, but he's a little bit more political about it, and I understand. But I want to read this particular statement that Dr. Graybois makes, and that is, unfortunately, even the results of multimillion-dollar controlled trials do not affect a change in physician practice. This was raised but not realized following the release of the thrombolysis and myocardial infarction trial. One conclusion from this trial was that patients deemed stable following thrombolytic therapy would no longer need coronary angiography, and this would reduce the number of patients undergoing the angioplasty by 25%. However, there is no evidence that this is the case. To the contrary, coronary angiography in post-myocardial infarction patients has increased. You wrote that, Dr. Graybois, and that kind of fits in with Guy's question on the fact that the CAST study and the veteran study and the European study all show that 80 to 90% of the procedures do not change the life expectancy of the person in a favorable manner.
Yeah, your caller is absolutely right, and you're absolutely right. And as I said earlier, there are just many reasons why people, why there's been a proliferation of these procedures. What's, again, distressing is the point that you raise is that we, as citizens of the United States, will be spending millions of dollars on these trials, and we have certain conclusions from the trials, but the problem is they don't necessarily change the way physicians are practicing medicine. I think that is, however, going to change. There's going to be a significant reduction in economic incentives to do procedures, and once the economics are pulled out of it, and once we reduce the number of folks who are being trained as specialists, particularly in cardiology, you're going to find that the numbers of procedures will diminish.
Why do you believe this? I've been hearing this all along. As long as I've been in the medical business, you know, 20-plus years, I've been hearing that things are going to change. And just like you say in the article, you know, they've gone from 30,000 to 300,000 angioplasties, and we've gone from 180,000 bypass surgeries to 380,000 bypass surgeries. And by the way, when that 180,000 bypass operations were done, we had the three studies showing that it didn't prolong survival, and now we've more than doubled the number of procedures. So why do you have faith that things are going to be different?
Well, I'm an eternal optimist. I have faith in that because there will be more significant government surveillance about this. And I think that's going to be both and good and bad, unfortunately. I think the physicians, we as a group, and yourself included, had a level of responsibility that we should have enacted in the 1980s in terms of putting a curb on the proliferation of these procedures. We didn't do it, and now I think the Clinton administration is going to step in and is going to do it for us.
Guy, do you have any other questions for Thomas Graybois?
Yeah, one more question. There's heart disease in my family, like my father and a relative of his had it. I've followed Dr. McDougall's program for 8 or 9 years now, and my cholesterol is like 110 to 120. Based on what you know of the scientific literature, what chances do I have of getting coronary artery disease?
I think if you have cholesterol down in that level, that really is pretty outstanding, and those are the kinds of levels that we didn't see, that it's very unusual to see atherosclerosis. I just would raise several points there. One, obviously, blood pressure has to be controlled, not smoking, exercise. All of these hygienic factors are obviously critically important. The issue of stress is a major player, I think. It's a major part of the equation.
Well, how does stress cause artery disease?
Well, I think stress can do it because it increases adrenaline, and if it increases adrenaline, it may increase blood pressure. It increases adrenaline. You also have increases in platelets, these little elements in the blood coming together, which can then attract the deposit of lipids.
Okay, one more question would be then, if I look at the Framingham study where they've said if somebody's had a cholesterol of under 150 for 30 or 40 years, there's never been a heart attack in there.
Yeah.
There has to be stressful people there.
You're right.
I
think that genetics also play an important part of this.
Okay, so could you give me
you're quite right. I mean, half the people who have heart disease don't have any of the traditional risk factors. So we have to say, how do we quantitate stress in those individuals? What may be stressful for one person is pleasurable for another.
Okay. Can you give me a figure on what sort of chance of me getting heart disease with a 110 cholesterol if I keep that the same for the rest of my life?
I just couldn't give you a figure. I think it's probably much less than mine.
What do you say, Dr. McTougall?
I'd say it's close to zero. But you know, I'm a believer that the primary factor in the development of heart disease is diet, and then you have secondary factors like smoking, stress, physical inactivity, and so on. And a diet, I see as the bottom line. And the reason I say that, of course, is because if you've got a good diet, even if you smoke, you don't get heart disease, and that's what the worldwide picture shows.
Let me add one interesting piece of information. I was part of a group that dealt with POWs coming back from Vietnam in 1973, and we saw POWs who had been incarcerated for 6 or 7 years and came back with cholesterols of 100, 110, because in fact all they'd been eating is rice and water, and yet they were under tremendous stress, and that group of individuals had a frighteningly high prevalence of coronary disease. Many of them were pilots and were trying to get back in flying status, and we had to undertake catheterization in that group.
That's interesting. Did they have a frighteningly high incidence of coronary artery disease initially when you saw them, or a year or two later when they started eating the American diet again?
No, these are people who were coming back. POW is trying to get back on flying status and went directly to catheterization.
And why did they go to catheterization?
Well, because for pilots at that point, in order to get back on flying status, they had to have a full cardiovascular evaluation, which included catheterization.
Did you publish this anyplace?
No, it wasn't published.
That would be just absolutely fascinating for somebody to be on a healthy diet for 6 years. And in terms of no cholesterol, low fat.
Yeah.
I mean, that's about as marginal. And that doesn't fit in with the war data either, at least from World War II and World War I autopsy data, but that's very interesting.
Yeah.
This is Dr. John McDougall on the Northern California Radio Network. We have Dr. Thomas Grayboys. His article in the Journal of American Medical Association 1992 tells us that nearly half the people. Dr. Grayboys, how did you go from 80%, which is what you told 80% of the people not to have an angiogram, and then when your conclusions, you got down here to 50%. Were you just being conservative?
Well, I think we were in part being conservative, but the data actually said 80%. But in fact, because patients came to us essentially seeking a second opinion, there was obviously a certain selection process. These are people who were actively seeking a second opinion, and therefore it would be more likely that they would opt for medical therapy and not go on to an intervention. So the 80% figure clearly is skewed in that respect. On the other hand, 50% I think is reasonable given the facts that I mentioned earlier. That is, in about a 6 or 7 year period, we doubled the amount of bypasses we've done, and therefore obviously double the amount of catheterizations, at a time when the prevalence of the disease is going down and the mortality from the disease is going down. So the 50% figure we thought was reasonable.
How do you think people would react if the news was out that half the time they went to buy a car, it would fall apart?
Well,
and do you think they would do anything about it if the figures were out that half the cars, you know, when you walked into the dealer and you bought a car, half of them you wouldn't get your money's worth or they'd fall apart? And how do you think?
I think we have to be very, very clear with patients about what we can expect and what we cannot expect from an operation or an angioplasty, and that's what we talked about as far as being an informed consumer. I think if I presented as a cardiologist to a patient that this operation will carry a 2 or 3% risk of dying and a 5% risk of having a stroke or a heart attack, there's a 15% risk of complications, and it will not prolong your life, it will not prevent a heart attack, but it will relieve your pain, you want that or medication, I would say a whole lot of people would say, hey, listen, I'm going to take the medication. I don't want to risk these complications or the risk of dying.
You're generous with your figures in terms of dying. The state of California showed a 4.6% chance of dying overall, a 7% for those that were over 65. And a recent study showed a 10.5% of the people that were of Medicare age never left the hospital when they had bypass surgery.
Oh, so yeah. You're absolutely right. This is not a benign procedure, and the definition, you know, of an operation, a major operation, is an operation done on someone else. If it's done on you, believe me, it's major. And the operating room is a place where there's a lot of stray bullets that get blown around, and you know, innocent souls get hit. In a recent study in the Annals of Internal Medicine, a third of the patients who are Medicare patients over age 65 undergoing bypass surgery had either a major complication. And there was a 6% mortality, a 6% death risk. So particularly as you get older, you have to go into this literally with your eyes open.
And you also talk about Dr. Hughes's work, which is the first time I've seen his work reviewed by anyone else. And you talked about the fact that of the patients who refused bypass surgery, the risk of dying for single and double vessel disease was zero, and the risk of dying for those that had left main and triple vessel disease was 1.3%.
Right.
And so you were quite impressed with this particular study, I would assume, to put it in your paper, especially since so few other people quote it, the fact that the people who refused bypass surgery did better than the surgical statistics.
Well, I think that's true, and I think that this disease is in many ways a benign disease. You can select a group of people who have a 1% or less risk of dying. And clearly, if your risk of dying is 1 or 1.5%, and the risk of having an operation is 3 or 4%, then you want to opt for medical therapy.
Well, it seems clear to me. I want to remind you to turn down your radios, and also that we are on delay, so you need to listen to the telephone if you're on the phone to talk to Dr. Graybois or any of our guests in the future. So let's talk to Edward in Sacramento. Edward, you're on the line with Dr. Thomas Graybois. I hope you're on the line. Edward?
Hello?
So you're on with Dr. Graybois. Now listen to the telephone and talk to him, okay?
Hello?
Go ahead.
Hello? My name's Edward Myers.
Go ahead, Edward.
Oh, well, I go to take a yearly physical, and recently I took a yearly physical, and my electrocardiogram, the doctor says, showed some irregularities.
Yeah.
And so he advised me to take a treadmill test, which I did.
Mm-hmm.
And then I did that treadmill test, and I seemed like I did it real good physically. I did the whole thing, and it didn't seem to make me very tired.
Mm-hmm.
By the way, I played tennis 3 times a week, and I consider myself in excellent condition. Now, the doctor said my treadmill test showed some irregularities.
Mm-hmm.
And now he wants to do another treadmill test with the dye in the veins.
Right, the thallium test.
And I was wondering if I should do that.
Well, it would really be improper for me to make any judgment about you, but in general, frequently people fall into exactly the kind of category that you're talking about. They go for a physical. There's some, quote, irregularity noted on the electrocardiogram. They have a treadmill test. The next thing is a thallium. The next thing is a catheterization. I think the point of it is that it's important to define whether you have any heart disease or not. And usually the treadmill test is very good at helping to define that. If it appears that there is some heart disease, then being on some type of medication, whether it's a small amount of a beta blocker and some aspirin, may be all that's necessary if you have no symptoms. And I think when people say to me, well, what should I do? I don't have any symptoms. If you don't have any symptoms,
no,
and someone wants to do a catheterization, then it's very reasonable to ask for another opinion.
That's a very important thing. It goes back to why fix it if it's not broke. It doesn't, I mean, essentially, because the surgery basically relieves chest pain and doesn't prolong lives. So what he's asking, what you're trying to do is make Edward a healthier, more functional person when he tells me he's a perfectly healthy, perfectly functional person, and they're trying to promise him something better in life. And it's really hard considering what they're talking about. This is Dr. John McDougall on the Northern California Radio Network. My guest is Dr. Thomas Graybois. There are lines open for you at 707-270-1350. We'll be back with you in just a moment. We have Denise in Sacramento. Denise, you're on with Dr. Thomas Graybois. Hello, Denise.
Yes.
You're on.
Hi. Dr. McDougall, first of all, I wanted to know if you could tell me the name of your book.
Well, do you have a question for Dr. Graybois?
Yes, I do.
Okay, the book is the
McDougall. It's a reference to my father, who's
okay.
Had two bypasses in the past, one in 75 and one in 79.
Good. Let's talk about that.
He he doesn't take any medications at all, and he's starting. These were bypasses in his leg. Does this still?
Are you familiar with bypass surgery in the leg enough to speak about it, Dr. Grabois?
Well, you're talking about he didn't. You're not talking about bypasses in the heart. You're talking about that he had some blockages in the vessels in the legs, and that's where he had his bypasses.
Yes.
Okay, can you make the question very specific so we can see whether or not Dr. Grabois feels comfortable about answering it?
Sure. He's having pain in his leg, and he hasn't had the procedure since 79. He gets really pale in higher elevations, and he's not taking any medications at all, and his blood pressure's okay.
Does he smoke
cigarettes?
Shouldn't
he go to his doctor and do something about this? I guess he's mentioned it. He's a Kaiser patient, and they haven't done anything.
Yeah. Does he smoke cigarettes?
He does.
Yeah.
And
thing is he must stop smoking cigarettes, because any kind of peripheral vascular problem is accentuated by cigarette smoking. Secondly is that people who have peripheral vascular disease, such as what your father has, frequently have other areas of atherosclerosis or hardening of the arteries, and it may well be in the heart. And he needs an evaluation, but first and foremost, he has to stop smoking. If he stops smoking, a lot of the discomfort he has in the legs may abate.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Okay. And I have one more question for you, Doctor.
Yeah.
Are you suggesting that cardiologists should always try medications and diet with their patients before angioplasties to see if it takes the symptoms away?
Yeah, I think that that should be the posture and the overwhelming numbers of patients that we see. Obviously, there's some individuals who are going to be deniers, who are not going to take medication, or some individuals because of their work, for example, pilots, that's a different story. But for the rest of humanity, you and I, this is the way we practice medicine here, and I think it's quite reasonable, is you want to concentrate on those factors that people can change the risk factors that have been discussed already,
well,
and put a patient on medication, and that is really the way to go before one proceeds to an intervention. You want to give the patient the benefit of the doubt that he or she can be treated medically.
Okay. Well, you just mentioned with this last patient about his left main artery. Whenever that's involved, is that an indication for surgery, or can you try medications with that as well?
It depends on the degree of narrowing, and it depends on the significance of the patient's symptoms. Everyone really has to be dealt with differently. We have a number of people who do have narrowing of the left main that we continue to follow medically. But if the patient was unstable, as was the situation of the previous caller, then it was clearly an appropriate procedure.
If it's just right coronary artery disease,
right,
and their symptoms go away with medications, is that an indication for...
No, they have a great outcome.
They do better with medical.
They do very well.
Okay.
Thank you for calling.
Thank you,
Doctor. This is Dr. John McDougall on the Northern California Radio Network. My guest is Dr. Thomas Grabois from Boston, from the Lawn Cardiovascular Center, the most prestigious cardiovascular center in the country. And we have Bill from Santa Rosa on the line. Hello, Bill. Bill, you're on with Dr. Grabois. And do we have...
Hi, Doctor.
Okay, Bill.
Thank you. God bless you, Doctor, and thanks for the good work you're doing.
Well, can you have a question for Dr. Grabois?
Hello, yeah.
Bill, you can't listen to the radio at the same time.
Yes, you're talking.
Okay, let's Linda,
we're talking about
yes,
the cholesterol. You're talking about the upper body. I've got a problem with the lower body. Maybe you could tell me something. I've had an angiogram, and they find my right artery is completely plugged. They couldn't even get the dye in for the angiogram, so they put it on the left side.
You're talking about in the legs?
Yeah, he's talking about peripheral
artery
disease.
Yes, I'm talking about the lower legs.
Yeah.
Both of them.
Well, they're very common, and while people can have a lot of pain with them, and certainly it's generally not life-threatening, and most folks essentially learn to live with that. And if they're really having problems with their walking, in other words, they can't walk 20 or 30 feet, then an operation or a procedure may be appropriate.
Dr. Grabois, we only have a minute left. If you had a chance to talk to Hillary Rodham Clinton, would you have an earful to give her?
I'd give her an earful. I tell her that we've got to, we really have to reimburse physicians for taking care of people, for sitting down and talking to folks, so-called cognitive care. That's where physicians should be reimbursed for, not for doing procedures.
Well, I'll tell you, this has been one of the most interesting hours for me, and I want to thank you for sharing your time and your expertise with us, and I want to encourage you to continue to challenge the establishment. This is Dr. John McDougall on the Northern California Radio Network. My guest has been Dr. Thomas Grabois.